That's what she said.
That's what she said.
That's what she said.
That's what she said. Well, that's what she said.
Welcome to That's What She Said, conversations with interesting people from the world of sports, music, comedy, and more, talking about their lives, careers, successes, and failures. Hello, and welcome to the latest edition of That's What She Said with Sarah Spain. My guest this week is Nell Scovell, a longtime TV comedy writer, and big shout out to my colleague, Dan, who suggested that I have her on the show because what a great conversation and what a fascinating woman. Love hearing about women who are sort of doing parallel things in terms of breaking down barriers in industries. Not quite the same as sports, but so very similar. And even just talking to Drew Magri a couple weeks ago about, you know, looking at our past in sports writing, and you do the same with comedy. You look back and you say the way that things were is not always the way that they should be, and that especially speaks to the diversity in the writing room. And Nell broke down a lot of doors in Hollywood in different shows, Letterman and Simpsons, that did not have strong female voices, and not only wrote in those places, but had the bravery and the courage and the agency to then speak out against them when they were still toxic places to work for women or people of color, and change things for the better. So I hope you enjoyed this conversation with Nell Scovell.
That's what she said.
So happy to welcome in my guest, Nell Scovell, a TV writer for shows including The Simpsons, Coach, Murphy Brown, Charmed, and Late Night with David Letterman. She's the creator of Sabrina the Teenage Witch, co-author of Lean In with Sheryl Sandberg, and author of the new book, Just the Funny Parts, and A Few Hard Truths About Sneaking Into the Hollywood Boys Club. And I was actually recommended to have you on the podcast because someone heard you chatting with Marc Maron and said, oh my God, it sounds like she's talking about sports but in comedy. And it's funny because you managed to do sports and comedy, which means you twice forced yourself to try to break down the doors of the Big Bad Boys Club. So I knew I had to have you on. And let's start back with the sports stuff, because that was kind of where you got started, even back in high school. I read that you were manager of the boys' track team in high school. How did that come about?
You know, I was a huge fan of sports. I grew up in Boston in the late 60s and early 70s when, you know, all the teams, you know, were world champions or almost world champions. I don't like to talk about that. And the Red Sox, even when they won, started winning, it's like, yeah, but I wanted, you know, Rico Petrocelli to win. So I love sports. I just wasn't very athletic. So, you know, there's that old saying that those who can't do teach and those who can't teach, teach gym. Well, it was like I couldn't run track, but I could time other people running.
That's so funny. So you end up going on to Harvard and you did some sports writing there for the Harvard Crimson. Was that something that you had thought career-wise was always your goal, was to write for sports?
I enjoyed writing sports. I think it was the least serious part of the paper. And I think my gut was telling me that I wanted to not be as serious as some of my peers. You know, you have to be creative with sports writing. It's emotional, right? It's the thrill of victory and the agony of defeat. You know, if you just report the numbers, that's not so much fun for either the reader or the writer. So, you know, I really approach sports with how do I make this entertaining, which is a good way to get into entertainment.
Yeah, absolutely. So what did your parents do when you were growing up? Was there a freedom to have a big dream at whatever, or was there expectation?
You know, I grew up in a very sort of nerdy Newton family, and I think I was expected to be a doctor or a lawyer. You know, they weren't. The whole Hollywood thing was just not at all part of my upbringing. In fact, I didn't even know there were TV writers till my mid 20s when someone suggested that, and then it was like, oh right, people must write for TV. But there certainly wasn't the same kind of reporting on TV and creators and showrunners the way there is today.
Right. So some of it was just being aware that the job exists, which is the first challenge.
Right. You don't want to lock into dreams too early.
Right.
But the other thing that was great about sports writing was I covered a lot of different kinds of sports, from tennis to football to lacrosse to crew. And I think I learned there how to adjust my style for different audiences, which became a key to writing for, you know, wildly different TV shows, you know, and being able to recognize that you can tweak your tone depending on what you're writing about.
Absolutely. And you're a senior at Harvard and you start doing work for the Boston Globe. So that's your first professional gig writing high school sports.
Right, for Vince Doria.
Yeah. Well,
Vince Doria was the editor. Yeah.
Yeah. Which, like, it's crazy because a lot of people that are listening to this pod that want to get into sports will say you already had a dream job and you weren't even out of college yet. How did you pull that off? And why didn't you stay there forever?
Yeah. I mean, one of the wonderful parts of youth is that you just accept these things as like, well, of course the Globe would just call me out of the blue and offer me a job. You know, there's that youthful arrogance that I think served me well. and there were times I wish I still had it. But I had written for the Crimson and had been associate sports editor under Jeffrey Toobin, who was the sports editor, who, of course, went on to be CNN legal analyst, Jeffrey Toobin. And the Globe hired four writers, traditionally from Northeastern, college-age kids, to cover high school sports. Vince Doria really wanted there to be a female writer. This was in 1981. Leslie Visser was crushing it. She was had broken into the boys' club at that point as a professional writer. And the woman from Northeastern that they hired fell out. And, you know, I so admire this that Vince didn't just say, well, we tried, grab another dude. He actively searched out someone who could fill that spot, which turned out to be me. And I'm so grateful to him. And listen, people talk about affirmative action. And yes, I got that job because of affirmative action. But affirmative action doesn't mean you hire someone who isn't qualified for a job. It means you hire someone who would not traditionally be selected for that job.
Yeah,
so I'll stack my post-Globe writing career against any of those Northeastern dudes.
Right.
And we'll see who got it because, you know, they weren't qualified. But look, this is why it is so important not to just try, but to succeed and make that effort because, you know, Vince Doria launched my career and that's, as he has many other, you know, women's careers at the Globe.
Yeah. And it's that,
and I imagine ESPN, but I just don't know that world.
Right. Yeah. He just retired just a few years ago. Yeah. You know, it's interesting. You know, the idea that the pipelines exist in most industries for straight white men, and if the pipeline isn't already there and you can't find them through that, then you give up versus creating them.
Right.
And that's the key.
Well, in just the funny parts, I say it's not a pipeline problem. I call it a broken doorbell problem, which is that there are these qualified people, women, people of color, people with disabilities who are there pressing the doorbell and nobody's opening the door.
Right. Yep. Yeah, exactly. So you leave the Globe and you start writing for Spy magazine. Then you end up at Vanity Fair. You run into an old spy editor later, and it was suggested that you write for TV. What did you know about TV, and was there any hesitation to leave what seems to be already a burgeoning career if you're writing for Spy and Vanity Fair?
Having that career of magazine writing was my safety net, and it's really why I think I was able to take the risk of trying to write for TV, because I kind of always knew if it didn't work out, I could go back to magazines. So, and even to this day, like, people have asked me why I saved so much memorabilia from my early TV years. And a lot of that's in the book, too. Like, I saved all my scripts with the notes that people gave me. And the reason I think I held on to this stuff was I thought it would go away. And I wanted to have proof that I had done these things. But I, look, taking a risk, should trying something new, should be the easiest thing in the world, because if it works out, that's wonderful. And if it doesn't work out, you just say, well, I'd never done it before. But you have that built-in excuse for failing. And so I just sort of jumped into writing what are called spec scripts, which spec is short for speculation. And, you know, those scripts led to my first jobs.
And the first place you tried to write for was It's Gary Shandling's show.
Yeah.
And the first script they liked but didn't get picked up, and that was not a deterrent to you. There was enough positivity there that you thought, all right, I'll give it another shot, and this time it'll work.
Right. And throughout my career and looking back while writing this memoir, I realized I got just enough positive reinforcement to keep me going. But man, if you like disappointment, Hollywood is a great career for you.
Yeah, I tried it for 6 years. It was very disappointing, to say the least.
Yeah, see, it is.
I actually took a TV writing class at UCLA. And what was interesting is I think my breadth of knowledge about TV was so limited that I realized that there weren't very many shows I enjoyed enough to want to write a spec script for, because at the time I was still very limited to what was on everyday channels, because I was poor. And so I wouldn't have even known that It's Gary Shandling Show or any of those even existed back in the day, because I didn't have all the access. So and I've never really been a fan of stuff that's on, like the Big Bang Theory is just, it's a mystery to me. I don't understand.
Yeah. No, that's fascinating. Actually, I've never heard that take, and it makes total sense. You know, It's Gary Shandling's show was a weird show.
Yeah.
And the popular shows at that time were Cosby and Golden Girls and I think Cheers. And they didn't speak to me the way this bizarre, you know, breaking the fourth wall show did. Do you feel like that's changed, though, that there are more shows now?
For sure, but also just that I didn't realize how limited, and how if I had really wanted to do that, I would have had to dive much deeper to know what I was even trying to get into. I just was like, oh, that sounds fun, but I didn't know enough about it to really even give myself a chance to get it.
Right. If I were writing a spec script today, I think I'd probably do this goofy show in another period that's on Comedy Central. Mm-hmm. And what would you do?
Well, I love Garfunkel and Oates. Well, I would have done the Mindy Project, which I loved, but that is now done. So maybe Champions, even though I don't love it as much, but I just love Mindy Kaling's style.
Oh, that's great.
Or Silicon Valley, but I wouldn't have the tech knowledge, so I'd have to co-write it. I think they're stuck in a rut, so I'd like to help them out of it. It's becoming entourage in Silicon Valley. So I wonder, you know, you wrote in the book about how Gary Shandling, when you pitched that first script, you wrote that spec script, he said, you write like a guy, and it was the ultimate compliment, and now you look back and you're like, wait a minute, that's not what
Wait a minute. Yeah, I think what he meant was back in the late 80s, there was this theory that men wrote hard jokes, jokes that made you laugh out loud, and women wrote softer jokes, you know, more like Rita Rudner, or, you know, more sort of thoughtful or emotional jokes. And, you know, I wrote dick jokes. Like, I wrote this one joke for my spec script where Gary's in the kitchen and his friend comes in because Gary's prepping for a party. And the friend says, do you need a hand? And Gary says, oh, that would double my sex life. So
I feel like that's in part because the expectation, even when a woman does write like that, is, oh, she's trying too hard, right? Like, there's this idea that that can't be a natural way. Like, I actually get that in my job. There's a show that I often guest on, and when I'm just being myself, it's, oh, she's trying so hard to be one of the guys. I'm like, no, that's who I am. So did you struggle with that at the beginning of, not just sort of like fitting in and being accepted, but also having people buy it coming from you?
Well, that's interesting. I do think, going back to the sports writing and the Globe, that really helped me, because I was very comfortable in that very, you know, testosterone-fueled environment, and, you know, Will McDonough on the phone chewing out Billy Sullivan, who was the then owner of the Patriots. And so I didn't flinch when that stuff was happening. And I think they look for that. I think they look for, you know, if I say, if I tell a dirty joke, is Mel going to laugh, or is she going to jump in and tell her own? So I was always the one who jumped in and told, you know, the even cruder joke. And I'm not, you know, I don't think I was faking it. I think that's, you know, like my love for science fiction or Monty Python growing up. Like, I never thought those were guy things. I just thought those were Nell things.
Right. Well, that's interesting, because, you know, on Mark Maron's podcast, you said that you thought that we had fixed equality when you got out of college, because Gloria Steinem had done the work and you felt like you'd get an equal shot. And I wonder, you know, I felt the same. I had a really strong mother. Both my parents were lawyers. They had a firm together. When I was at Cornell, it felt like all the opportunities were in front of me. And it wasn't until a little bit later, when I actually got out there, that I realized, oh, it isn't just you can do whatever you want if you work hard.
Yeah.
So it's interesting that sort of is something that becomes presented to you later sometimes.
Right. And so at first I'm fueled by this naivete that I can do anything. And then when I started hitting walls, and I did, I mean, literally people would say, you know, Craig T. Nelson is never going to let you run coach. So if you want to keep going up the ladder, you should probably go to another show. Mm. And then the naivete turns to, you know, I don't know, this form of, it's not quite anger. It's wanting to prove yourself. And it's more frustration, I guess, and saying, I'm not going to let you stop me from, you know, doing this thing I want to do.
Yeah, for sure. One of the early experiences that you had that sort of pointed out that there was work to be done was working for Letterman. And it was a very short tenure. And you ended up writing a Vanity Fair editorial about how it was a hostile work environment.
I wrote the piece, just to be clear to listeners, 19 years later, after Letterman comes out and talks about how he had sex with women who work with him. And listen, everyone was commenting on this, you know, his confession. And, you know, people who had nothing to do with the show. I remember Barbara Walters goes on The View and says, you know, she defends him and says, of course he had sex with women he worked with. He's a very attractive man. Where else is he going to meet women except the workplace? And having been someone who really felt demeaned by not just him, and I mean, actually, the weird twist is Letterman himself was one of the nicest people to me at the show, but because he set this example, there was a lot of unprofessional behavior at the show that made my time there very uncomfortable.
Yeah, you know, it reminds me of right when the stuff came out about Matt Lauer, and Kathy Lee Gifford compared it to forgiving her husband for cheating on her. And I felt ill. And it was, of course, before some of the details came out. But I thought, that's not the same thing.
Well, Matt Lauer, since you brought him up, you know, has this tiny walk-on in Just the Funny Parts, where after I write this Vanity Fair piece, the Today Show wanted to book me as a guest to talk about the scandal. And I was talking about something slightly different, which was sexual favoritism in the workplace and then gender discrimination, because at the time, neither Letterman nor Leno had any female writers. And I really wanted, you know, to call attention to that. So the Today Show invited me on. I say no. Then my phone rings like an hour later, and I hear, "Hi, Nell, it's Matt Lauer." So Matt Lauer calls to try to convince me to be on the show. And I say, "Look, I don't want to talk about interns in the bedroom. I want to talk about women in the writer's room." And Matt says, "Well, you don't have to talk about interns in the bedroom. In fact, I couldn't be held to that high a standard." Oof. And he chuckles. So I decide not to go on the show because, frankly, that creeped me out.
Right.
But what's fascinating to me is all these coworkers of his who claim, like, we had no idea about Matt when he busted himself to a stranger
right.
5 minutes into a conversation.
Right.
Crazy.
Yeah. Yeah.
But that's how normalized it is.
Right.
Really, yeah. He thought I was like, I think he thought I'm connecting with Nell over this, not mm-hmm. I'm creeping her out.
Right. Right. Exactly. Were you worried about writing that piece for Vanity Fair about how it would affect? I mean, it was 19 years later. It was a slightly different atmosphere. But as we've seen, even during this whole Me Too, not that much has changed for a lot of people. A lot of people are still pushing very hard back against exposing stuff like this. Were you worried about getting jobs at other shows?
Yes, I was. And I do think it hurt me in some ways. And the show attacked me in the press. And that got a little ugly. But no one has ever refuted a single point I made in that article. And I know it's 100% correct and the truth. So that's, you know, makes me really proud. And then I also think once you speak out, and I know not everyone can, and it was a privilege that I got to, you know, it did put me on a different path. And part of that path led to Sheryl Sandberg and helping her write speeches and eventually helping her write Lean In.
Yeah. I mean, clearly you have to become a voice that somebody sees and seeks out, that knows that you're willing to do that and push the boundaries,
yeah.
To be honest. Yeah.
Yeah. And so, I mean, I would do it again.
And, right.
I was actually working on a show at that time. It was called Warehouse 13. It was this great show on the Sci-Fi Channel. If you've never checked it out and you're looking for a TV show, it's really smart and funny. And occasionally in the Warehouse 13 writer's room, someone would say something sexist and someone else would say, you know, watch out, Nell's going to write an article about you. And I would always say, yes, 19 years from now, you're going to be really sorry you said that.
Hey, everybody, don't forget to go to ESPN and Apple Podcasts and subscribe to That's What She Said with Sarah Spain so you always have the latest episode. Don't forget to rate and review it as well and tell all your friends how awesome it is.
You also talked about one of the things that really stood out to me was you were one of the first women ever to write an episode for The Simpsons. You wrote an episode for the second season. And then it was another over 100 episodes before another woman wrote an episode. And you said that Sam Simon, who was one of the creators and was in the room, said, "I'm going through a divorce. I don't want any women in the room." And that was the excuse for having no female writers. And that is
right.
Such a,
actually,
in one sentence.
I just spoke. I just want to clarify. He was actually breaking up with his wife. He wasn't going through a divorce at that point.
So breaking up with his wife. I don't want any women. Either way, it's sort of this little microcosm, this little sentence that speaks to so many larger issues, which is the idea that I'm going to punish all women for one, right?
Yeah.
The idea that you would ever say the same about men. Well, I got in a fight with my best friend who's a man, so I don't want any men in the room. That would never happen, right? Do you think that anybody else there agreed with him on that and thought, okay, that's a fair reason for us to go 5 years without hiring another woman?
Oh, well, clearly everyone. I mean, they've done a ton of studies that show that abuse is worse in workplaces that are hierarchical. Mm-hmm. And that makes sense. You know, when the power is concentrated at the top, then people don't feel comfortable stepping forward and saying, hey, you know, I looked around the room and I noticed just a lot of white male faces. You know, maybe we want to change that. We have characters like Marge and Lisa. You know, we might want a female perspective in the room. That doesn't happen when you have these hierarchies.
Yeah. Well, and it feels like that is true for every industry, right? If you don't have a diversity of voices,
yeah.
You might find yourself in, and it happened in sports with Ray Rice punching his fiance, these big panels of all men kind of fumbling their way through repeating terrible stereotypes about domestic violence and very quickly networks realizing that they should have some women on staff, which they didn't already. And
right.
So, yeah, I think there's a lot of opportunities for different industries to realize too late that they needed to have a better quality of diversity in the room.
And not only having the diversity in the room, but listening to them. Because, mm-hmm. you know, I can't tell you how many times I was in a writer's room and I said, a woman wouldn't do that, and got shot down by all the other men.
Yeah. Well, so I talk in sports industry, and I've done a couple little panels or speeches, and I'm sort of honing this idea that I've realized in my own by talking to other women in the industry that there's this sort of pivot, right? You start out in order to get anywhere, you have to fit in. So you have to play the game and be one of the guys, and sometimes keep your mouth shut during moments that you would like to speak up and things that you think shouldn't be going on. But if you play the game, then you're given a chance to change the game once you've got some sort of voice and agency. And you have to decide at some point whether you want to make the pivot from I'm blending into I'm disrupting and making people uncomfortable by talking about things that need to change. And there might be some people that don't like me as much as if I just continued to play the game, but it's worth it for me to make it different for the next person and make it easier for everybody else. Do you feel the same way about being a woman in comedy?
100%. I love that description. You should write a book about that.
I'll work on it.
Yeah. Yeah, no, that's exactly right. And again, not everyone has the privilege of speaking out. I also think it's important to have standing. And by that, I mean, I had a successful career when I wrote the piece about Letterman, and it allowed me to speak out without sounding like I was bitter because I hadn't made it and was blaming other people for that. Now, there are plenty of people who should have made it and didn't because they ran up against sexism, but it's harder for them to speak out.
Yeah, for sure. Did you feel like was that Letterman, was that your pivot moment? Or before then, had you already sort of, not just by virtue of being there, because I think that's different than actually vocalizing. Had you been vocal before in places?
Oh, no, Letterman was absolutely the pivot point for me, completely. And I had, you know, I had pulled showrunners aside before and said, you know, I don't think you realize you're doing this, but, you know, we have one person of color on the staff and you keep pointing it out, like every day you make a joke about it. Mm. And maybe you don't want to do that. You know, so I don't think I was shirking from standing up for other people, but I came out as a feminist in that article.
Right. Right. You know, it's tough because there is this feeling of you don't want things to change because you're a woman, because disrupting the space is the excuse that they can use not to invite you in. But at the same time, success isn't being allowed into a space where you then feel uncomfortable because you allow them to not change any behavior that shouldn't have been there in the first place. So how do you balance that?
to me, the answer to everything is more women and more people of color and more diversity. And I do think there's an imbalance of discomfort in workplaces where the others bear a disproportionate amount of discomfort. And we need, you know, people to who are privileged to edit themselves so they're not saying insensitive things, you know, and if that means being more aware of the politics of the room. I have spent my entire career being aware of the politics of the room.
Right.
And it is possible to do that and your job.
Yeah, it's funny, actually, because there's this, I'm sure you've heard of him, Brent Musburger, actually used to work for ESPN yeah. and now has his own thing going. And a couple different times while calling games, they would show a beautiful woman in the crowd, and it was as if he was incapable of filtering his feelings about her. And people seemed to defend him in such a way that, oh, it's, you know, just, it's part of the job. And I, if a woman who was attracted to any of the players out there said it once, and meanwhile, the entire game is men. You literally only had to make it through the 5 seconds that they showed a woman, which is almost none of it.
Right.
It's all men playing. And you couldn't do it, which I think is to your point, like that especially the others are constantly aware of the dynamics in the room and how to not disrupt them and draw attention to themselves in a way that could spoil everything, right? Whereas the people in power are expected so rarely to even just edit and filter themselves, which is such an unfair balance for those of us that are not the norm.
Look, I still, like, one of the most painful moments for me, this isn't in the book, but I was sitting in a room when a showrunner went off on, the show had hired a female black director, and she was set to start, and he was nervous about it, and said something in the room about, I bet she only gets jobs because she's a black woman. And I looked down, but man, if I could go back in time, I would protest, or I would get up and walk out, or I would say that's a horrible thing to say. And the kicker is, I was actually producing that episode, and she was maybe the best director we had all season. I have never seen anyone more prepared for a shoot. She was on time, on budget, amazing. And it is hard to balance. When do you stand up? When do you go, that's not right? You shouldn't say that. In fact, legally, you cannot say that.
right.
But then you're like the, you know, Nell can't take a joke, or I was kidding, or
right.
Oh, it's not that big a deal.
Or then you're invited, not invited to do the work. As I know you mentioned before that there was a bunch of guys that came in with a bunch of work you'd done over the weekend. They said, oh, well, we all got together around the pool and finished it already. But you have to, as they say in Hamilton, you have to be in the room where it happens.
Yeah.
You know, and so if you establish yourself as outside, even just by calling out behaviors that are actually illegal, then you still might just get yourself uninvited from the work.
Yeah. Yeah. So that is, I don't know. I'm definitely more outspoken now than I was at the start. But I don't know what the answer is.
It's
every individual has to make their own choice.
You mentioned when you talked to Mark Maron that somebody told you every show's looking for a woman, so you're lucky. Of course, woman. And it's the same in sports. I have a straight white male friend who said, totally straight-faced, complained that there was no room for him because people were looking for something else. I said, except for the fact that the entire network is mostly made up with that. Right.
And throughout history. I mean, look, it is a moment in history where it's true. There are cases where a qualified man might not automatically get the job because there's also a qualified woman or person of color, and that gives them an advantage because it should be an advantage to have all the experiences that may not be represented in that room. And I feel badly for those guys. The ones I don't feel badly for are all the mediocre straight white men who use that as the excuse for why they're not getting hired.
Yep. You know, you co-wrote Lean In with Sheryl Sandberg, and it was both a defining movement and also a very controversial book. And there was some very interesting reaction to that book, much of which people believed was not even specifically to what you and Sheryl wrote, but to who she was and what she represented to people and why they didn't want to take advice from this millionaire woman. What was your reaction to how that book was received?
Well, they say the reason to write a book is it starts conversations. And I think, you know, by that metric, Lean In from the start was an amazing success.
Yeah.
And, you know, Sheryl, I call her, she's the one I was waiting for. I think she does the most remarkable job of showing the underlying cultural bias and how the, you know, that big picture feeds into the details. So I know it's changed a lot of individual lives. You know, she sends me the emails she gets from women saying, you know, I was scared to ask for a promotion, but I read your book and then I did and I got it. And so, you know, that, and the other thing where I think Lean In has really changed the culture. And again, this is all Sheryl because she so walks the walk. I think women are more supportive of each other today than they were 5 years ago. Mm. And I see it, especially with younger women, that the rising tide will lift all boats, to drop the there can be only one mentality and realize that we will go farther if we are together.
Right. I think the scarcity of jobs was not something created by women, but because it existed, it made it feel like it was me versus you. And now instead people are pushing back on that scarcity and saying, wait, there should be more than one and I'm taking you with me. And that's definitely gotten much better. You created Sabrina the Teenage Witch, and
I did
have a great family story of bringing my new boyfriend home and walking in on my dad watching Sabrina Teenage Witch by himself, and too much time passed that he couldn't claim that he was flipping channels. And now we always just, because he also is a big fan of Charmed, which is another show you wrote for.
Oh, that's so funny. Yeah.
And he's this, you know, mostly serious lawyer guy, but he's got a great sense of humor. But for whatever reason, he was into the fantasy, the witches, who knows what it was. I don't know. Maybe he thought that Melissa was cute. But do you have other stories of unlikely people approaching you about some piece of work you did and saying, okay, I've reached out to people I did not expect?
Oh, that's so funny. You know, David Wilde, who writes for Rolling Stone, and you know, his great rock and roll cover stories, when Sabrina first came out, he wrote this article just in praise of the show and how subversive it really was. And so that was amazing, being in Rolling Stone. And it was not a typical TGIF show. If you go back and watch, you know, I brought in people like Chris Elliott and Dana Gould and Bryan Cranston to play parts, because they were all people I admired and had worked with before. So there was a lot going on below the surface of Sabrina.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, well, before I let you go, you have to do the one thing that everybody does and nobody expects.
I didn't expect the kind of Spanish Inquisition. Nobody expects the Spanish Inquisition.
That's right, it's the Spanish Inquisition. The 10 questions everybody gets asked. Number one, what's the natural talent you wish you were gifted with?
Oh, singing. Singing. I wish I could sing.
That's usually the answer. We've got a lot of wannabe Whitney Houstons. Number two, what's your desert island album? You can only have one.
Oh, a Tapestry by Carole King.
Oh, good one. Number three, if you could switch lives with anyone for a day, who would it be?
Oh, LeBron.
Oh, guys.
I mean, you know what would it feel like to be LeBron?
You're only the second person who has chosen someone of a different gender, which I find fascinating because that would be the first place I would go, just to see.
Yeah.
LeBron would be a good one. Not when he's getting whooped by the Warriors. We'll see if that happens. But number four, what's the most scared you've ever been?
Oh, directing. Having to
really?
Direct. Yeah.
Did That's you ultimately like find it. It enjoyable? Oh, so you did like it. You liked the feeling of fear.
No, to me, fear means you're challenging yourself.
Yeah. Yeah. Number five, what's the most embarrassed you've ever been?
Oh, yeah. When I had to go through a second divorce before the age of 26, that was pretty bad. It's in the book, but I just didn't realize that when someone proposed, you could say no.
It's good to know. Yeah.
Yeah.
Number six, what would you consider your biggest failure?
Oh, not being more diplomatic.
In what sense?
It took me a while to learn the importance of persuasion.
Right.
You know, that it's not always about swinging the sledgehammer of truth.
Right. You catch more flies with honey, that sort of thing. Yeah.
Yeah.
Number seven, what habit or quality do you think has contributed most to your success?
Persistence.
Mm-hmm. Number eight, have you ever been in a fist fight?
No.
Ever been close?
No, there was in junior high. Yeah. One girl cornered me in the bathroom and it could have gotten ugly, but it didn't.
Did you talk your way out of it?
I think I cried my way out of it.
That works too. Nine, what's the thing about yourself you'd most like to improve?
Well, everything. You know, I just think I just want to always get better at everything. But specifically, directing.
Yeah. And you're still doing that?
Not currently, but I'd love to do it again.
Yeah. Number 10, what three words would you most hope people would use to describe you?
Funny, fearless, and short. That's just the truth.
And finally, the bonus, who would you recommend that I have onto this podcast to have a conversation with?
You know, Robin Schiff, mm-hmm. who wrote Romeo and Michelle's High School Reunion and was a mentor to me, and is just great.
That sounds
smart,
great.
Funny. But she's not a sports person.
That's quite all right. I prefer not sports people sometimes. I've talked to plenty of sports people.
I also love Lynn Povich, who wrote The Good Girls Revolt, book about she was at one of the Newsweek girls, in quotes, who sued for gender discrimination.
Mm, that sounds very interesting, too.
And she's awesome. Maury Povich's sister, too.
Yeah, yeah. That would be a very good one, then. Shirley Povich.
That's right.
Yeah. I really enjoyed talking to you. Good luck as you continue promoting the book.
Oh, thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Oh, and another thing.
This week's That's What She Read is an obvious one. Obviously, go out and get Nell's book. Go out and buy it and read it, the whole thing. But while you're waiting for it to arrive via Amazon Prime or waiting to get out to your local Barnes & Noble, you can read an excerpt on Vanity Fair. The headline is My Soul Did a Spit Take on Being a Woman in the Late Night Boys Club by Nell Scovell from February of this year. And you can read a little bit about writing for David Letterman, what that atmosphere was like, the story that she wrote for Vanity Fair, exposing it for what it was, and even the surprise appearance from Matt Lauer that she just mentioned in the podcast. So you can find that on vanityfair.com, and then you can, after reading the excerpt, go out and buy just the funny parts and a few hard truths about sneaking into the Hollywood Boys Club, her book. Thanks, as always, for lasting about an hour with me.